I want to thank Pastor Wright for inviting us. We went to one church and the board was very skeptical about having someone come and speak about abortion. They said, we don't have that problem in this church. Well, by the close of the weekend, I was able to tell the pastor that, yes, indeed, you do have that problem in this church. But because it's a secret and most people don't talk about it, who knows, right? One of the concerns about speaking on it is making somebody in the congregation feel bad who's had an abortion. And yes, indeed, we need to be sensitive to that. But sometimes I think we hide behind the sensitivity. I think we use that as an excuse. I was one of the people in the congregation. I sat there for years, and nobody talked about it. And I believe it's because maybe nobody knew how to talk about it. For me, that was until I met my partner, which you'll meet later, Antoinette. Antoinette was at a youth conference, and she had a booth, and I had never seen her before. And I'm thankful to the Lord to this day because she did use her voice, and she answered his calling and didn't shirk it. She wasn't afraid. She did something about it. I want each one of you to know you are here tonight for a reason. The Lord will anoint you with a ministry. There are people right now who need to be ministered to be given hope that you could very well be that person. So before I get started, I want to just look over some numbers. Now, the Guttmacher Institute is the research arm of Planned Parenthood, and every year I look them over just to see what they're putting out. Apparently, they're more accurate than the CDC, which also puts out data every year. Between 1973 and 2011, 53 million legal abortions took place. Now, it's probably around 57 million. Guttmacher used to put out the number, but for some reason they've stopped. 19% of all pregnancies end in an induced abortion. An induced abortion is an intentional abortion, intentional interruption of a pregnancy where the life of that fetus is terminated. And there's two types of this induced abortion. There's medical and it's surgical. Medical is when you use drugs to terminate that pregnancy. They're called abortifacients. The second one is surgical. A surgical abortion is invasive. This is when they go inside the mother's womb and remove the fetus and the placenta. Now, nearly half of American women will experience an unintended pregnancy by the age of 45, a pregnancy that was not planned. 4 in 10 of those pregnancies are terminated. Half of these women have already had one other abortion. 89% of abortions occur in the first 12 weeks of the pregnancy. So who are the women? They're not any different than you and me. 18% of women obtaining abortions are teenagers. 57% are in their 20s. 44% of all abortions performed in the U.S. are college-age kids. About 61% of abortions are obtained by women who already have one or more children. 37% of women obtaining abortions identify themselves as Protestants. 28% identify themselves as Catholic. Well, I was one of the Protestants. I grew up a Seventh-day Adventist. My mother saw to it that I was in Sabbath school each week. I was a pathfinder. I went to summer camp, loved it. When I got old enough, I worked at summer camp and loved it. I went to our church schools. It was an elementary school that I was baptized. Now, I went through the academies. It was an academy when I gave my heart to Jesus. Now, I had been baptized, but this is where I really gave my heart to Jesus. I was 15. Academy was awesome for me. I was in the band, the choir. I loved the Bible conference trips and the temperance rallies. I was involved in all of it, and I treasure those memories. But college was harder for me. It was during this time that my parents got a divorce, and I saw the inconsistencies in my church and the hypocrisies, and it threw me for a loop. I had to step back for a while and ask questions. Questions that I'm sure a lot of young adults have to ask. Is this where I'm supposed to be? Is God here? Does God even exist? Was I just growing up in some enchanted little protected bubble, and this is reality? Well, God is so good. He knows how to answer all our questions. He's not threatened. So by the time my college sweetheart and I were to be married, we both knew we wanted a Christian home, and we wanted a Seventh-day Adventist home. Even with all the problems that I saw, I knew the Lord had anointed this church and that we had been given a high calling. But with that said, 6 months before I was to be married, everything was shattered. I found out I was pregnant. And I was devastated and embarrassed to death. How could I break my grandmother's heart? How could I face the people in my church, the critical faces, the disappointed faces? Now, my husband and I, we had only been intimate once, but that didn't matter. No, that didn't matter. What did make matters worse is the fact that I had had a series of x-rays on my lower back. I was a traveling nurse, and the hospital I worked at in Reno required a series of x-rays. And when the tech asked me, is there any way you could be pregnant? I promptly said no, which only added to my embarrassment later, because I knew there was a chance. Well, I called every physician I knew in the area and asked them what they would do if I were your wife. I was panicking and I was afraid and I was alone. Every single one of them said, I would want her to abort. I called my husband, David, my fiance at the time, and you know, I don't even remember what he said. I hardly remember the conversation, but he did fly to Reno to be with me, and he paid for it. Well, life was a blur for me. I was in a daze. I called the clinic. I asked how much, how far along I had to be, and how much it cost. At the clinic, I talked to a counselor first. She was a very sympathetic ear, not a Christian, but she was sympathetic to my dilemma. And she assured me at the time that it was just a fuzzball. I had nothing to worry about. Well, I was a registered nurse, and I had studied plenty of anatomy and physiology. But it never occurred to me to ask that question. It wasn't a fuzzball. So, my life had to have been in a complete panic blur for me to go through the procedure without any anesthesia. I was scared to death. I look back now and I can't even imagine where my mind was. The procedure was a nightmare. The pain was so bad I lost consciousness. And it made an impact on me that would affect every aspect of my life for the rest of my life. But because I was emotionally numb, I had no clue what was going on. Now the doctor, when I got there, was very nice to me. I was crying and I was shaking. I was so afraid. And he came over and he held me, and I remember being comforted by that. But when I passed out the second time in the recovery room, he got angry because he was having to spend more time with me. And you see, he was in a hurry. He had so many he had to do that day. Well, when it was all over, I did feel a sense of relief. But for me, it was very short-lived, and it was harrowing. It was so harrowing, in fact, that it just about destroyed me. I wasn't able to deal with it. I hated myself, and this man that I loved with all my heart was my best friend, all of a sudden became repulsive to me. I had terrible anger towards him. I hated him. I hated his religion. I hated hearing him talk about his religion. You see, I had wanted him to protect me, but he was just as clueless as I was. It would be unfair for me to hate him. The very things that I wanted in a man became the very things that repulsed me. My dear husband had no clue as to what was going on with me. I don't think he had any idea how the abortion had affected me. I felt destroyed. How could he want intimacy when that seemed to be the very thing that had destroyed me? You see, the topic of abortion had never been a part of my life. I had no clue what the effect of making that decision would have on me. Now, at the time, I had the best friends a girl could ask for. We all met in Hawaii. We traveled together. We loved each other. I have no doubt that they loved me. But not a one of them counseled me not to go through with it. You see, they didn't have any idea of what it would do to me. I know that if they had, they would have said something. But instead, they made a big dish of eggplant parmesan for that evening when we got home from the clinic. Now, I taught my children when they were young that panic kills. When you panic, you are not thinking straight, and you're likely to do something really stupid and get yourself killed or get somebody else killed. Think it out. Keep your head. Think it out. You can do it. Now, when my husband was in school, I worked in a regional burn unit for a while. We would get very serious burns flown in to us. And every once in a while, we would have a case where the individual had actually run into a fire instead of away from it, simply because they panicked. Well, when I found out I was pregnant, I panicked, and I ran into that fire, and someone was killed. Now, after we'd been married a short time, I got up one night, I got the scissors, and I promptly cut all my hair off, stubs. David wondered, who have I married? But you see, there was to be nothing lovely about me. I was constantly punishing myself. There would be times when I would sit on the toilet in the bathroom and I would take the razor and I would run that razor up the inside of my arm. Just run it up. You see, on the inside I had all this pain, but on the outside I was numb. I needed to feel that I was still alive by feeling that pain. People around me were clueless. One of the girls I worked with at the unit, she saw my arm one day and she goes, Diane, what on earth? What happened to your arm? And I just told her it was the cat. My cat did that. When I became pregnant the second time after we were married, I was already convinced that I was unfit and terrible. There was no way I could ever be a mother. And I had a second abortion. I called the clinic, lied about how far along I was, set the date. No emotions this time. No fear, no crying. I went in, I listened to their little speech, and I got it over with. Now, just as that baby had been taken mercilessly from the security of my womb, my identity was being stripped mercilessly from my soul. Now, by this time, bulimia had complete control over me. Shame destroys, and I was being destroyed. It digs a big, deep, nasty, painful hole that you try to stuff just to deal with the pain. And that's what I would do. I would stuff food down until I couldn't even swallow. And then all of a sudden, I would have this enormous upheaval. It was all coming out. I was getting it all out. And strange as it may seem, I felt pretty good afterwards. I felt like, oh, I won't have to do that again. But when I was compelled to do it again, it just confirmed the failure I was. And I would sink deeper into that pit of lonely shame. So, many of the joys of being a new bride were taken from me. I fought with depression, and I couldn't sleep. And eventually, I went to a therapist, and she promptly gave me the antidepressants and the sleeping pills. She never took a personal history to see what might be at the root of that. Well, after a while, I gave up on it, and I just stopped taking those pills. Wasn't taking care of the problem. Well, we went to a marriage counselor, and she promptly told us on the first visit that she didn't think our marriage could be saved. We were devastated, because even though we didn't know what was going on, we knew we loved each other, and we wanted to make this work. She never asked us if we'd ever had a miscarriage, a stillbirth, or even an abortion. Things that can cause all kinds of unresolved emotions and play havoc with a relationship. She never brought it up, and we certainly weren't about to bring it up. So we left there, disappointed, never went back. One night, I scraped up the courage to call a 1-800 number. It had been on the radio, "If you've had an abortion and you regret it, call this number." I literally hid in the washroom. It took that much courage to even get it out of my mouth. I went into the washroom, shut the door, called this 1-800 number. She answered, sounded pleasant. I told her my story. The first thing out of this woman's mouth was, "Well, you know abortion is murder, don't you?" There was no hope, no hope in that. I hung up. And I wanted to vomit. Well, not too long after that, a friend I worked with asked us if we would like to go to church with them the next weekend. Well, we loved this family. Her parents were like my surrogate parents during dental school. So we went, and wouldn't you know it, the sermon that day was on abortion. Now, this guy was very loud and very animated, Bible thumping, and he got louder and louder and louder, and finally he said the Lord would not and the Lord could not forgive a woman who had had an abortion. Well, of course, he quickly recanted, but for someone like me and the congregation, he confirmed every reason I had for hating myself. These events, as you can understand, shut and locked the door for me to ever ask for help for a long time. That abortion was supposed to be the solution to a crisis, but instead, it created a larger-than-life crisis. But according to the abortion advocates, the post-abortive woman should be feeling fine about her decision. After all, she was exercising her right. It is her body. But is it really? Weren't we bought with a price? The fruit of our womb is bought with a price as well. If she doesn't feel fine, it's because something was wrong with her prior to the abortion. If there is emotional instability after the abortion, it's because she was unstable prior to the abortion. These are actual quotes. Some pro-choice activists claim that it is our religiosity, our religion, that causes us to have a hard time after choosing to have an abortion. Well, I found that particularly fascinating because in the late 1800s, thousands of women suffering from hysteria were being incarcerated. Leaders of the French Enlightenment also held and encouraged the view that it was the dangers of religion that caused this hysterical behavior. Now, even though there was significant evidence that this hysteria was the result of sexual abuse at a young age, there was no political and no social support for further investigation. And thousands of women remained locked in their asylums. Their hysterical behavior was in response to a trauma. But instead of validating that trauma, the credibility of the victim was attacked. We saw the same thing in the wartime. Under the relentless horrors of trench warfare during World War I, men started breaking down in shocking numbers. They began to produce symptoms that resembled the hysteria in women. They would scream, cry. They wouldn't be able to speak. They wouldn't respond. Now, the military authorities at this time attempted to suppress these reports because of the effect it would have on the public. They insisted that true men, noble men, would never succumb to the terror, but find glory in the challenge. And it was declared that men who were susceptible to the hysteria of women had defects in their masculinity. How sad. Once again, the credibility of the victim is attacked. It wasn't until our Vietnam vets came home and started sharing stories with each other. They would form rap groups, and they started validating each other's story. Do you know it wasn't until after Vietnam that the definition we have today for post-traumatic stress disorder was even established? Well, sadly today, there are many men and women locked in their own private asylum due to the trauma of an abortion. And once again, there is little political or social support. But should we be surprised by that? As Christians, what are we doing? Christians tend to make it a political issue when it's a spiritual issue, guys. Prior to the 1960s, investigations on the effect of abortion concluded almost without exception that abortion inevitably caused trauma, posing a severe threat to the psychological health. By the late 1950s, population control advocates set their sights on regulating birth control and abortion. Major population donors, the Rockefeller Foundation, made research dollars available to prove the benign nature of abortion. And the subsequent shift in political and social and scientific thinking was all perfectly coordinated. By the late 1960s, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, and the American Psychological Association all reversed their prior positions of opposition to abortion. They cited this new body of evidence purporting that abortion was fine, benign, safe, and actively began supporting the repeal of all the anti-abortion laws. Since Roe v. Wade in 1973, the commitment of these professional health organizations has not wavered. Their reasoning began to suggest that the negatively affected woman or women were those who were most psychologically fragile before their abortion. Once again, instead of validating the trauma, the credibility of the victim was attacked. Now, in the late 70s, women who had experienced either emotional or physical effects from their abortion started banding together. And in 1982, an organization called WEBA, Women Exploited by Abortion, was established. In 1982, they had chapters in all 50 states with thousands of members. That right there speaks for itself as far as the trauma. Now, when this is what the pro-choice, the advocates of abortion have to say. When the pro-life community turned their attention to the concern of abortion harming women, their critics accused them of coming up with a new strategy to bolster their agenda against abortion. When we started validating the trauma of abortion, it was only claimed to be a new strategy. They put it like this: post-abortive trauma is nothing more than an attack on the right to choose policy on abortion. Critics believe there is no such thing. Critics call it melodrama. They insisted on not validating the trauma. Well, the American Medical Association may be calling it a myth, and the American Psychiatric Association may be trying to crush or suppress any recognition, but the evidence of the trauma continues to accumulate. 61% of women feel guilty for what they've done. 52% deal with depression. Still others deal with anger and sorrow. There's grief and bitterness. 52% said they've suffered regret. They've endured anguish. There's remorse, despair, shame, unworthiness. There's loneliness, hopelessness, helplessness. 57% felt self-condemnation, confusion. There's anxiety, there's self-hatred. 54% were unforgiving of themselves. They experience emptiness and uncontrollable weeping. And there's a loss of dignity. Now, listening to this, you can see why so many end up with drug or alcohol abuse or other self-punishing behaviors like cutting, eating disorders, promiscuity, suicidal thoughts, and repeat abortions. Then there are the career problems, problems with relationships, friendships, bonding with other children, future children, problems with intimacy. So the percentages on the previous slide are actually low. Delayed reactions and refusing to participate in studies are two factors that drastically affect this. You see, over 60% of the women surveyed reported that there was a period of time when they would not have reported any negative reaction or feeling about their abortion. They reported that it was an average of about 5 years before they'd even acknowledge negative feelings, and another 10 years before they would even consider confronting and dealing with those negative feelings. Many times, it can be 30 years, 20, 30, even 40 years. Ladies in their 80s that feel they're about to die call, "Can the Lord forgive me of this? There was a time when all of this was just material I'd read in a book, But I've been doing this long enough now to know that yes, indeed, there is a trauma and there is an unresolved grief that needs to be dealt with. They need to be given hope. Now, this delayed reaction is one of the major reasons why post-abortion trauma is so misunderstood. In longitudinal studies, 50 to 60% of women who've had abortions conceal it. Oh, for years I concealed mine. I would go to the doctor, and you know how they do the little history and physical? Oh, I dreaded the part when they'd say, how many times have you been pregnant, and how many children do you have? I didn't want to lie, but I didn't trust anybody. There was no way I was going to write down two abortions. 60% of women who initially consent in the short-term studies change their mind. Dr. Julius Vogel, he's a psychiatrist and an obstetrician, and he has performed over 20,000 abortions. And he insists this: every woman, whatever her age, background, or sexuality, has a trauma at destroying a pregnancy. A level of humanness is touched. This is a part of her own life. It can't. When she destroys a pregnancy, she is destroying herself. There is no way it can be innocuous. There was a Los Angeles Times poll that found that 74% of women who had even admitted to having had an abortion stated they believed that abortion was morally wrong. Another study showed that 70% believed abortion involved the killing of a human life, violating their own moral standard. Now remember, this is only represents those who are even willing to take such a participate in such a study. The numbers are probably higher. Moral dilemmas, by their very nature, involve an emotional and an intellectual conflict over what to do. What to do? Now, this conflict for many produces a powerful sense of crisis. I've experienced that powerful sense of crisis. And they leave women completely overwhelmed. These women oftentimes will rush into an abortion without ever examining the full range of their beliefs, needs, feelings. Just in the last couple weeks, I read a study where 85% of women who chose abortion felt like it was the only option. Now you think about that. That's a dark spot. That's a very dark spot. It's time they start hearing God's children, their voices. It's time we start breaking that silence. Another very sobering aspect of this is that those who are in this state of crisis are more vulnerable to outside influences. The state of crisis, especially when it involves a moral dilemma, causes people to have less trust in their own opinions and abilities to make the right decision. This leads them into a state of heightened psychological accessibility, in which they become more reliant on the opinions of others, especially authority figures. What better authority than that of Jesus Christ as sons and daughters of God, right? It's a pretty sobering situation, but I will tell you this. I wish one of those doctors had said, Diane, just wait. Come and see me. Let's talk. Now, you know, it might not have changed a thing for me, but it might have changed everything just for one doctor to speak up. So what about the men? Men have learned that the same law that gave them no right to protect their children from abortion has also quietly but effectively been telling them they should take no responsibility. If you'll remember, 3 years after Roe v. Wade, they shut the man down. Even if he wants that baby, he has no say. As a result, when men were asked how they felt about abortion, before even realizing they were going to be involved in one, 66% were neutral, even though they would be the father of that baby. It's a women's issue, right? Well, I asked my husband what he thought about it, and he didn't have a lot to say. It was legal, and he wanted to support me in my decision. I have no doubt about my husband's love for me. But you see, he had never been talked to about abortion. His community had also been silent. He wasn't being a jerk. He loved me the best he knew how at the time. Men faced with an unexpected, unintended pregnancy are smacked in the face with a no-nonsense, no second act drama. It's real, and it will impact them for the rest of their life as well. So how do they deal with it? What is their role in this critical drama? If 66% are neutral, then basically they are clueless as far as the effects of that abortion. Common responses found in men, well, both may mutually agree to the abortion, or he many times pressures her to abort, or someone else pressures her to abort, and he just sits idly by. He abandons the relationship. He passively leaves the abortion decision to her. She chooses abortion against his will. He may not even know about the pregnancy or abortion till years later, if ever. We've met men that fit each one of these roles. It's really sad when you see a grown man weep because he didn't step up to the plate and protect his unborn child. Even though there's the women's right to choose factor, in reality, men are intimately involved in the abortion decision. In 95% of all cases, men play a central role, one way or the other, in that decision to abort. And about half of these men are sitting in the clinic waiting rooms while their lover or wife is having her abortion. Regardless of how the decision is made, men who have had a personal abortion experience are just as much at risk of post-abortion stress as the woman. Some men may experience various symptoms or problems and not even realize it has anything to do with that abortion. Anger, helplessness, relationships, grief, guilt. Now, both men and women tend to repress these feelings, but men are much better with it. We were driving in a car once, and David was real deep in thought. And I asked him, what are you thinking about? And out of the blue, he said, I wonder what our child would have been like. I tell you, I was shocked because I didn't think he ever thought about our children that we didn't allow to live. Men have the capacity to deeply repress areas of loss and pain. Facing these feelings leads to a sense of vulnerability, loss of control, and weakness. This is when the men throw themselves into work. Workaholic is very common. Pornography is another very common response. Affairs, anything to escape the vulnerability in his attempts to maintain control. Relationships become dysfunctional, and family life suffers. So, we can't remain silent about this issue anymore. After that 1-800 helpline experience, which offered no hope for me, and then the preacher who just confirmed there was no hope for me, it was 6 years before I ever trusted anyone to tell them my story. I was painfully insecure. I had food hidden everywhere. I spent money we didn't have. And my marriage was in shambles, complete shambles. But life goes on, and you live the facade. In fact, you get pretty good at living that facade. I had a 3-year-old son and 6-month-old twins. No one had a clue. Well, right when things did hit the wall, the fan, my sister called me and she goes, "Diane, I want you to go see a friend of mine, a Christian woman." I did. I didn't really even know what to expect. I know I had gotten to the point in my life where all I could say was, "Lord, just hold on to me. Just hold on to me." Well, I went to her. She was a godly, lovely woman, and she had discernment. And she brought me back to the cross, and she helped me pray. She would say a little bit, and I would say it after her. And she would say a little bit, and I would say it after her. She loved me, and I trusted her. And before I left that night, I shared my abortion stories with her. I dug it out, and I shared it with her. Now, she was very serious with me about those decisions, and she took me back to the cross, and she helped me confess that sin, the sin of abortion. She wasn't afraid to do that, and I'm so thankful for that, because all because she called it a sin didn't mean she loved me less. If anything, she was protective of me, because she knew the devil had been having his way with me. So she stepped in. She wasn't worried about being politically correct. She stood in the gap for me, and I want to meet her in heaven someday. Well, that night I got back to my sister's apartment because I went to where she was living, and I went to bed. And all of a sudden, I experienced something I had never experienced in all my life. I experienced the Lord. I sat up in bed, and I lifted my hands towards heaven, and I felt this wash come over me. He took the bulimia completely away from me. He took that. I had destroyed my esophagus and the sphincter to my stomach. I mean, I had just destroyed myself, healed all of that. My teeth were being ruined. He stopped that. I believe he did this for me because he knew I would need confirmation that he had indeed forgiven me. God is good to forgive us our sins, but often those sins come with pain and consequences that need to be dealt with. So often that issue is tucked away, that part of it. No one knows how to deal with it. But if that unresolved grief, emotion isn't dealt with, it's going to continue to surface. And unfortunately, this pain causes many women and men to start doubting their forgiveness. We've had women call us and say, "I asked the Lord to forgive me. Why do I still feel so miserable?" There was more work to be done. Now, this affected my life for another 20 years. And over that years, I maybe shared with 2 or 3 people. One person was, "Don't tell anybody. Who have you told? Don't tell anybody." Another person's response was, "I know, you're sharing this with me because you want to test the relationship just to make sure I will still stay around." And I can remember thinking, well, boy, that's a bit of information to be testing this relationship with. people didn't know. How are you doing? If someone shares an abortion story with you, they are trusting you. It's okay to say, how are you doing? Have you dealt with it? It wasn't until I attended a retreat for post-abortive women that I was to understand the incredible need to have that trauma validated, deal with my denial, acknowledge my loss, my baby, and grieve the loss of that baby. I had to confront that forbidden grief before I could finally forgive me. Abortions wounded are now seeking recovery programs at a record rate. It can no longer be ignored. The Journal of Behavioral Health Services and Research had this to say. Young women who seek help for distress after abortion are fast becoming a new underserved population within healthcare, primarily because they have been marginalized by the politics surrounding abortion and thus remain untreated. Fascinating. They're not able to ignore it anymore. This stress is not only a response to a psychologically stressful event, but also a perinatal grief. We seem to forget that there was a child in all of this. The need speaks for itself. And as Christians, I'm afraid that if we don't take a moral stand on this issue and show the world and each other right here in this room who it is we put our trust in, we're going to miss out on a grand opportunity to minister in the name of Jesus. And we are going to have regrets, possibly throughout eternity. And we don't want that, do we? It's our responsibility to sow the seed of hope to others. Let us bless the Lord at all times. Let his praise be continually in our mouths. Let our souls make their boast in the Lord. The humble, the vulnerable will hear it and rejoice. Oh, magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. Let us make the nations around us jealous for our God. But the only way we can make the nations around us jealous for our God is to allow God to work. And if we keep interfering by not trusting him, how is he ever going to do for us like he wants to? Right? We want those to see who our God is and what mighty things he can do. Especially through this subject, because that baby, regardless of how small, is the workmanship of God.
Friends, I hope the Lord helps you to see what a gift you've been given in Diane Wagner. You think about the embarrassment that you might feel over having done something when you were young. You stole a pack of bubble gum or you cheated on an exam. And you think about the embarrassment you might feel of having to return to someone and apologize for something that you've done. This woman gets up with incredible courage, unbelievable courage, and bears her soul on something that is so phenomenal. And what's so incredible is it's something that the enemy has meant for utter and complete destruction. It's something he intended for total devastation. And every single time she gets up and she shares her story, the Lord literally takes what the enemy intended for destruction and shoves it back in his face and says, "Not anymore." And he's using her story over and over and over again to be a conduit, a channel that helps to set yet another captive free. Not just men and women who are post-abortive, but men and women, young and old, pastors and lay people who are held captive in their thinking. When my mother first believed that she was pregnant, she was in a very destructive relationship. Her husband was an alcoholic. He was both physically and verbally abusive, and she didn't want to have her baby. She had decided, she was in Georgia at that time. This was back in 1981, and she was originally from California, and so she said, you know what, I'm going to give money to a friend for safekeeping, and when I finally have enough money, I'll go to the friend, I'll get the money, and I will be out of here. I'm just going to go home. Abortions were free in California. She was going to go home, have an abortion for free, and move on with her life. When she went to the friend and said, hey, I'm ready to go, I need my money, her friend looked at her and said, what money? I spent all of it. It's all gone. She didn't know what to do. She didn't know where to go. Well, her husband, my biological father, had cut out this ad in the paper, and it said, hey, I'm alive, voice of the preborn, Columbus, Georgia. And she was experiencing morning sickness. He knew that. And so she went to this crisis pregnancy center. And while she was there in the session, she said, will you help me have an abortion? They said, we won't help you have an abortion, but would you come back for some counseling? And so she ended up going back for counseling. And while she was there, she picked up this magazine while they were speaking to her. It was a magazine from 1965. And in 1965, a photographer took pictures of the baby in utero. It was the first time that the world had ever seen the baby in the womb. And it showed the different stages of development throughout the gestational period. And as she picked that, as she flipped through the pages, she saw fingers and toes and arms and legs. She had no idea that the baby inside of her was in fact alive. And as she looked through those pages, the Holy Spirit simply fell on her. And she said, I don't know what the future is going to bring, but I am going through it with my baby. Well, that baby was me. And there we are, together. What's important to understand, though, about our story is that our circumstances did not change. My mother chose to have me, to love me. The church that the Crisis Pregnancy Center was operating out of, it literally embraced us, just wrapped its arms around us. Not just saying, you have to have this baby, interceding for that life, but wrapping their arms around her in that pregnancy and that relationship. And so it's important to understand that, you know, people, when they are talking about an abortion, the crisis situation, there are a lot of very valid concerns that women have. Who's going to help me? The father won't support me. What are my parents going to say? I'm in an abusive relationship. They're not concerns we should just dismiss. It's just there's another part of the conversation that's very critical that we must consider. Well, when she was, so I like people to understand the circumstances didn't change. And as I grew up, I grew angry, I grew bitter, I grew resentful, I was very wounded. And my father was very wounded. He had experienced a tremendous amount of pain and wounding when he was young, as he was growing up. And it was a cycle that was perpetuating, continuing in itself. And I grew angry at the Lord. I thought the Lord was unfair. I thought the Lord was unjust. Why are you allowing me to experience this life? If this is the race that you've called me to, I don't really want to run it. And so it was in that mindset that I eventually went off to college, and I began to date, and I began to experiment sexually, and really made a lot of mistakes that were very, very regrettable, and did turn my back on the Lord. I knew what he wanted. I knew he wanted me to turn, and I said, no, I'm not going to do it. What's amazing, though, about the Lord is that he never stops his pursuit, not ever. And what's phenomenal about every single one of us here, everyone who can hear my voice, is that no matter what we've done, and no matter what we might do in the future, his love for us does not diminish. Even though people will be eternally lost, we know that's true. His love for us, for them, it doesn't diminish. It breaks his heart when we run from him. But his love for us, his attitude toward us, stays the same. One of my favorite verses has become Micah 7:8, and it says, "Do not rejoice over me, mine enemy. When I fall, I will arise. When I sit in darkness, the Lord will be a light to me." And that is what the Lord was. When I sat in darkness, he came for me again. He'd rescued me out of the darkness of my mother's womb, out of that, what could have been an amazing tragedy. And he came for me again. And he's done it over and over and over and over again, where he comes and he rescues and he restores and he redeems. After I had come back to the Lord, I was about to head off to law school. And my mother actually had come across some information about the Sabbath day, and she handed, you know, passed it along to me and said, "Really consider this." And so I did. I began studying and really considering worshiping on Sabbath. I was raised in a Southern Baptist church, the same church that had embraced us in that crisis pregnancy. They really were just phenomenal group of people. But when the information about the Sabbath came to me, I was really in a place that was prepared to receive it. And as I studied it and looked at it, I became convinced I need to worship on Sabbath. And so I was about to head off to Virginia, and I began worshiping at a Messianic synagogue, actually, which I don't know if any of you have ever gone to a Messianic synagogue, but they are a lot of fun. They are Jews who believe in Jesus as their Messiah, and it was a whole lot of fun. I really loved it, but I was still searching in terms of where my true church home would be. And so, once again, my mom had said, "Well, what do you think about, would you consider Seventh-day Adventists?" And I had not had really a lot of interaction with Seventh-day, well, not a lot. My great aunt and uncle were Seventh-day Adventist, and they were very precious people, but they were also very real Seventh-day Adventists in the sense of the dietary laws. And this was back in the 80s, and I'm sure many of you can remember fake meat back in the 80s. It was actually quite different, and it's gotten much better, so much so you can't even tell the difference when you have fake meat versus real meat, but back then you could definitely tell. And so that was sort of my only interaction with Seventh-day Adventists, although they were very precious people. So I went ahead and said, okay, I'll give it a shot, and I started attending an SDA church in Virginia, and I absolutely fell in love with them. I fell in love with the people. I fell in love with the teaching. I fell in love with the fact that they were very real. These people were real, just like me. They were working out their salvation, just like I was. But they wanted to know the Lord. They wanted to spend forever with him. There was a genuineness there. And I knew I've come home. It was like coming home. I knew that I had found my husband. And by his grace, I would never let him go. It was about, I would say, 2010. I was going to graduate from law school in May of that year. And one afternoon, I started wondering what the church's position on abortion was. I'd actually never considered what the church's position on abortion might be, because we are commandment keepers. And I went home, started looking it up, started doing some research. And when I found what the church's position was, I really had a crisis of faith. There were inconsistencies there that I found extremely alarming. And I knew if I cannot join this church, there's nowhere else for me to go. And so I cried, I prayed, I struggled. And I spoke to people about it, spoke to the pastor about it, spoke to a woman who acted like a head deaconess for me about it. And no one could reconcile the position with Scripture. And said, we can't reconcile it for you. So my last Sabbath there in Virginia, I was at potluck. The church always had potluck, which was awesome. I was exposed to so much wonderful food. And there was a visiting couple that was there. And as I was just hashing this out, really wanting an answer, the wife of the visiting couple said, "You don't not join the church. You join and you seek to change it." And so in September of 2010, I was baptized into the Adventist Church, and early 2011, the Mafgia began. Mafgia, it is a Hebrew word, that's me and my mom now, right there. Mafgia, that's a Hebrew word for intercessor. And it comes from the verse Isaiah 59:16. And it says, he saw that there was no man, and he wondered that there was no intercessor. Therefore, his own arm brought salvation for him, and his own righteousness, it sustained him. We, as an organization, we are committed to interceding for the value, for the sanctity of human life from conception, from our very first moment to natural death. But we're also committed to interceding for the reconciliation and redemption of women and men who have experienced the tragedy of an abortion. It's not just about the baby. It's not just about the parents. There are many, many people involved in a decision like this. And our desire is to set free, to be a conduit that helps set captives free in every way as it pertains to this issue. What's been really profound, Mafgia began early 2011, and Diane came on in 2013. And I prayed for a woman who had experienced the redemption of the Lord who was post-abortive. And boom, Diane Wagner, wow, absolutely phenomenal. And the Lord has just worked through the story. He's worked through the honesty, the vulnerability. The stories that have come to us, they are heartbreaking, but they're so emblematic of the need. The need is deep. The need is great. The need is undeniable. And the question is, what will we do about it? The impact we've seen primarily in three ways that have been very, very profound. The first is the frequency of abortion. When we've spoken, and we've spoken, we've interviewed with 3ABN, we've spoken at GYC and ASI and at the Amen convention to doctors and dentists. We've spoken at numerous churches doing seminars across the U.S. And exhibited at different conventions as well. But we've only focused on Adventist audiences, not secular audiences. The number of abortion, the frequency is staggering, where a woman will have had one, two, three, four. There was one woman who wrote us, she had 12 abortions. 12. And you think, very much like Diane's story, she's treading water, barely surviving. Who is going to help her be set free? That's us. The frequency of abortion is staggering. What's also phenomenal is the way that abortion affects has affected us generationally, where a mother will have an abortion and then her daughter or daughters will also have an abortion, but they're not talking about it. And so the mother will have one and be suffering in her own shame, and then her daughter has one too, suffering in her own shame. And there was never a conversation to say, I regret this. Please don't go down this road. Or a woman will have had an abortion and her sister and cousin will have had an abortion as well. It's absolutely affecting family units. And keep in mind, for every child that's lost through abortion, there's a father of that child. We have made a grievous, grievous mistake. And I love that Diane talks about the way that abortion affects men in saying that this is only a woman's issue. That is a flat out lie. Flat out. This isn't just only a woman's issue, and we've done a great disservice to women by throwing this at their feet when men are equally as culpable, as responsible for this situation, but also just as much in need of the redemption that the Lord offers and brings. The third way that we've seen this abortion really affecting our people is in the condemnation and shame that is still affecting lives 10 and 20 and 30 years later. What happened in Diane's story, the way that it was done at a young age but wasn't dealt with fully until decades later, that's pretty typical. It's actually much more rare that a woman would have an abortion or a man would father a child who was aborted at a young age and they deal with it immediately. And so we're seeing that these people are literally dying under guilt and shame and condemnation for 10 and 20 and 30 years. I don't know how many of you have struggled with condemnation. I have. I know what it's like, and I'm not post-abortive. It doesn't matter. The enemy isn't a respecter of persons in that sense. And if you've ever struggled with condemnation, if you've ever struggled to really believe that the grace of the Lord really is sufficient for you, it completely immobilizes you. It takes you out as a human being. Because how are you going to speak about the love and the grace and the joy of the Lord when you don't really believe that it extends to you? So we literally have thousands upon thousands of men and women in our pews every Sabbath morning. But they have no idea what it means to truly be walking in the freedom and redemption the Lord offers. Who is going to help set them free? That's us. It's our job. What really was the primary difference in my story and Diane's story? Because it's really critical. There were people who believed not just in my value, but in the value of my mother. They didn't just see her as some woman in crisis to be shoved to the side. She wasn't someone who you fling money at and say, you deal with it. They believed in her value as a human being, as someone made in the image of the Lord. Not just my value. Praise the Lord, they believed in my value as someone made in the image of the Lord, but in her value, that they were willing to intercede and say, daughter, please don't do this. There is another way. Through their intercession, through their pleading, my life was spared, but so too was her life. They fought for our sakes. They went to those uncomfortable places. Can this conversation be uncomfortable? Yes, this can be an uncomfortable conversation. And yet, is it a conversation that desperately needs to be had? Yes, 1,000 times over. I will say, if you come back tomorrow, and I hope all of you will, we'll help you learn how to have this conversation, because it's a conversation that desperately needs to be had. And something that I've discovered in my own life is when the Lord asks me to do something, I feel kind of uncomfortable. Go talk to that person about this, or hand out the steps to Christ to them, or give that person some food. And I feel self-conscious. The Lord has said, Antoinette, do you know why you feel self-conscious? Because you're focused on you. Jesus was never self-conscious. Not ever. He was never thinking about himself. He continually and completely lived for the other. He was never focused on him. He doesn't know what it's like to be self-conscious. We're self-conscious because we're looking at us. What are they going to think about me? How are they going to respond? Are they going to be mad? Are they going to be this? Are they going to be that? Listen to this woman's story. Guys, she's literally a gift that the Lord has wrapped up and said, here, this is the need. You can't have a clearer picture than the testimony you've heard tonight of the need and the story of redemption that continues tomorrow. Wow, will thrill your soul. So I really hope you come back to hear it. That is the need. It is there. And we have to be willing to go to those uncomfortable places in order to rescue, to be the hands and feet that rescue. This is what we have the opportunity to do. The people who interceded for my life and for my mother, they did not foresee that over 30 years later, I'm 35 now, they didn't foresee that my life would be used to intercede for someone else. They didn't foresee that my voice would be used to speak on behalf of someone else. They didn't foresee all that would happen in the future. They did as the Lord was asking them to do. They walked as he's told them to walk. That's what he's telling us to do. That's how he's telling us to walk. The question is, are we going to do it? Will we do it? The need is there. The need has been there. What hasn't been there is people willing to have the conversation. The people willing to say, I will stand on this word of truth. No matter what anyone else says, I will stand on this word of truth. Acts 26:18 says, I am sending you to open their eyes in order to turn them from darkness to light, from the power of Satan to God, that you may receive forgiveness of sins and an inheritance among those who are sanctified by faith in me." I love that Diane brings out in her story, what if just one person had said something? What if just one person had said something, had interceded, had pleaded with her? "Daughter, do you understand that you were literally crafted by the Lord of the universe? Do you understand that your child was literally crafted by the Creator of the universe? Do you understand, dear daughter, that you were brought into existence by the finger of the Lord? Do you understand that your child was brought into existence by the finger of God? Do you understand, sitting here tonight, that that is the value that you possess? The finger of God brought you into existence. You possess a value, a significance that no one and nothing can take away. No matter what brought you here, no matter how old you are, no matter what roads you've walked, you possess a value that is literally written onto the canvas of eternity because you were made in the image of the Lord. What if just one person had been willing to do that? What difference might it have made in her life, in her marriage, in her family, in her church family? What difference might it have made? I love that she is literally a walking miracle. A walking miracle. But there are millions upon millions of men and women who are desperate to believe in the dark of night, when they're just alone with their thoughts, that the grace of the Lord really does extend to them. Diane's story is not typical. Freedom and redemption is not typical. Because we want to say, it was my choice. It doesn't matter. I'm fine. It had no effect on me. It has devastating effect, devastating consequence. And yet people are treading water and they are dying inside, desperate to be set free. Diane was dying inside, desperate to be set free. And look at what the Lord is doing, because someone was willing to intercede for her. If we will do this, if we will accept our duty, our calling, we think of duty, I must. It's literally our calling as believers to be the hands and feet of the Lord that help to set the captive free. That is our calling as believers. And if we will do it, if we will embrace this calling, we will watch as women, as men, as young and old, as marriages are restored, as family units are restored, as church communities are restored. Because people are carrying around a lot of secret stuff. That's not a condemnation. That's a reality. This issue in particular. Secret. We've met women in ministry, and they've been in ministry for years. But they've never told anybody about their abortion before they told us. How? Are we really going to share that joy when we don't really believe it's ours? Moreover, think of that life that actually has just been snuffed out. And so we can talk a good talk, but we don't believe the truth of it is ours. If we will take up this calling, we will watch as a transformation, literally a revolution of redemptive grace, takes place. And it is happening. We are seeing story after story after story pop up where women and men have experienced redemption and they have to share it. Like where Jeremiah says, "The truth was burning in my bones and I could not hold it back." This is our calling. The enemy, he had a lot of intention for me at my beginning. Abortion is not just an abstract idea. The evil one intended that I would never, not ever, walk the face of the earth. But I do. The evil one intended that my voice would never be lifted in praise and honor to the Lord. But it is. The evil one intended that my voice would never be used to intercede for another. But it does. Abortion is not an abstract idea. Its casualties, born and unborn, their flesh and blood. But you know what? Those who are rescued, redeemed, their flesh and blood too. The Lord is waiting for a people who will stand on the truth of his word, who will refuse to compromise it, and who truly will be hands and feet that help to free, to bring people back to the cross in redemption and restoration. Our desire, our prayer, is that you would be such a people. Thank you. I'll close this in prayer. Lord, I thank you and I praise you for the opportunity to share here. I praise you for these people, Lord. I thank you for their lives. I ask that you'd bring all of them back tomorrow. I truly do. Lord, that they would catch a glimpse, a fire of the value that you've written onto their lives. That this issue is about so much more than the rightness and wrongness of something. It's about reawakening people to the value that you have given us, that we possess because of you. I praise you for that. I praise you that we are not here by accident. We're here at this time in history on purpose, with incredible value, destiny, significance. Will you go with us as we go home? Praise you for your Sabbath day and what it means, Lord. And bring us back tomorrow. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
This media was brought to you by Audioverse, a website dedicated to spreading God's word through free sermon audio and much more. If you would like to know more about Audioverse, or if you would like to listen to more sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.